This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, July 24th, 2002. From Mexico City, I'm Deepa Fernandez. More corporate scandal. Today, three of the founding family of Adelphia Communications are arrested for looting their own company. In Florida, Salvadoran generals found liable for torture. And as we conclude our July summer special reporting from Mexico, today we look at the alarming increase in deaths of Mexicans crossing the border. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The European Union has decided to replace the International Family Planning Aid package canceled by the Bush administration. Charlotte Parsons reports from London.
Europe is giving poor countries the help that the United States withdrew. The UN Population Fund was left $34 million poorer on Monday when the Bush administration announced it was ending aid payments. Anti-abortion groups have been pressuring the president to stop funding groups that offer advice on abortion. But the UK International Development Secretary, Claire Short, led calls for the EU to provide the money instead. She is eager for Europe to play a leading role in global population policy. The EU believes that reproductive health awareness is an essential weapon in the fight against poverty. The Population Fund operates in 22 countries, offering help and advice on family planning and sexual health. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Charlotte Parsons in London.
United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan will not hold further talks with Iraq until officials in Baghdad indicate they're prepared to allow UN weapons inspectors back into the country. Susan Wood reports from the UN.
According to the Reuters news agency, that's what Annan told Security Council members yesterday at an informal meeting. Reuters reports Annan also stressed that the channel for dialogue should remain open. A third round of talks between the UN and Iraqi Foreign Minister Naji Sabri broke down July 6th in Vienna. Iraq blamed the U.S. for the breakdown, accusing Washington of putting pressure on the UN delegation and of using the weapons inspections issue as a pretext for attacking Iraq. The Bush administration has repeatedly threatened a military strike to topple Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, whom it accuses of developing weapons of mass destruction. Meanwhile, according to Reuters, Iraq is seeking assurances from Annan that the U.S. won't carry out those threats. But the Secretary General, while making clear his opposition to the use of military force, has said he cannot address that issue. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
Israel wants to sell a so-called missile defense system to India, but since the Arrow weapons system is a joint venture with the United States, the U.S. must okay the deal. While U.S. officials believe India and new ally Pakistan are no longer close to an all-out war, State Department spokesperson Richard Boucher said they will look at the bigger picture. He added, if you can build a missile for defense, you can build it for offense. A new report from the General Accounting Office says records from gun purchases should not be destroyed as quickly as Attorney General John Ashcroft would like. Joshua Chaffin reports from D.C.
Attorney General Ashcroft's proposal to start destroying gun purchase records the day after the transaction could be implemented any day. Currently, records are kept for 3 months after the sale. The General Accounting Office says the three-month period helps authorities audit sales to ensure guns aren't being sold to criminals. Nancy Hua of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence agrees with the GAO and says Ashcroft is being hypocritical.
You know, really, one can only conclude that he cares more about paying lip service to the interests of the gun lobby than he does about actually preventing terrorists and criminals and other people from getting firearms.
Criminal defendants around the country have started challenging gun charges against them based on Attorney General Ashcroft's recent decision to widen the scope of the constitutional right to bear arms. While the courts have supported the right to bear arms as part of state militias, Ashcroft has extended the Second Amendment to mean every individual in the nation. The New York Times reports today Ashcroft is alienating his Christian conservative supporters and some in the White House with his post-9/11 behavior. Joshua Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Washington, D.C.
An American Muslim activist and writer is now in FBI custody for allegedly having terrorist ties. Catherine Martins reports.
James Ujamaa, a Seattle-based man popular with the black community and praised for welcoming former gang members into the local mosque, is being held as a material witness, which permits the FBI to hold him indefinitely. Ujamaa and other former members of that now-closed Seattle mosque are suspected of having al-Qaeda ties, including the planning of a terrorist training camp in Oregon. Ujamaa, who heads a website opposed to U.S. foreign policy, is also believed to have provided al-Qaeda with computer equipment. In a jailhouse interview, Ujamaa denied planning terrorist attacks. His brother, admitting that Ujamaa had traveled to the Middle East, said that it was wrong for his brother to be branded a terrorist because of where he had prayed. Formal charges are yet to be laid against Ujamaa. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Catherine Martins.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Three members of the founding family of troubled cable operator Adelphia Communications Corporation were arrested today as government officials claimed they looted the company they created over 50 years ago. John Hamilton has more on the story.
Five former top executives of Adelphia Communications were arrested in Pennsylvania and New York on charges of securities fraud, wire fraud, and bank fraud.
With these words, Deputy Attorney General Larry Thompson announced the first criminal indictments handed down against corporate executives since the collapse of Enron triggered a wave of accounting scandals. The five Adelphia executives arrested include founder and former CEO John Regas, his two sons, and two other top financial executives. The suit alleges the Regas family used Adelphia corporate revenue as a personal piggy bank, stealing millions of funds for airplanes, luxury hotels, even a private golf course on the Regas family estates.
Together with their co-conspirators and senior management, the complaint alleges that members of the Regas family that controlled Adelphia systematically looted the corporation. In less than 4 years, the complaint alleges they stole hundreds of millions of dollars and through their fraud caused losses to investors of more than $60 billion.
The arrests came just hours after the House and Senate reached agreement on new legislation that will create new criminal penalties for corporate fraud. But the White House's apparent crackdown on corporate crime is seen by many working Americans as too little, too late. Many point to the questionable sale of Harkin Energy stock by George W. Bush while he was a senior executive at that company, as well as Dick Cheney's role in a Halliburton accounting scandal while the vice president was at the helm of that company.
Today, as I walk along the street, just talking to strangers, I can feel the feeling of the communities not liking what's going on in corporate America.
David Lehman is president of CWA Local 2204 in Roanoke, Virginia, which represents Adelphia cable workers. He says the retirement savings of his union brothers and sisters have taken a beating as accounting scandals have rocked the telecommunications sector.
Not only just the members in Adelphia Cable, but members in all the cable industries and communication industries, private sector, public sector that we represent, many of our members who have 401k plans and savings plans that they want to retire under have been diminished immensely, like Quest. They're running into the same problem that the Adelphias are running into, and the Quest stock has went from $101 a share down to like $2 a share today.
Lehman says his members won't be as badly harmed by Adelphia's collapse as Enron workers, many of whom lost their retirement savings with more than half of their 401k plans invested in company stock. He's also optimistic that Adelphia's new managers are committed to returning the company to viability and retaining CWA jobs. The communications workers and other unions are among those lobbying Congress to strengthen corporate crime laws. Jeff Miller is a spokesperson with the CWA.
Well, we think this is certainly yet another case that cries out for the kind of reform that's being discussed in Congress. And we're certainly very interested and very supportive of Sarbanes legislation and other proposals to tighten up on this kind of accounting fraud.
Whether indictments at Adelphia are a response to public outrage over corporate malfeasance or a sign of things to come remains to be seen. Of the dozens of U.S. companies now facing charges of fraudulent accounting and other illegal business practices, no one has yet to serve any jail time. With the Workers' Independent News Service for Free Speech Radio News, I'm John Hamilton.
Yesterday, as the world condemned Israel for its missile attack that killed 15 people, the U.S. House of Representatives approved a $200 million aid package to Israel that they say is to fight terror. A quarter of that amount was approved for the Palestinians, provided they say the money does not go to the Palestinian Authority. The Senate votes on the aid package today. Meanwhile, in Gaza, Hamas held a big funeral for the dead today, which witnesses say were attended by hundreds of thousands of Palestinians. Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres told the BBC that the Hamas leader they killed was a, quote, sort of local Osama bin Laden. And as Qatar Mesta reports from the Gaza Strip, Israeli attacks on Palestinian civilians occur every day.
Every night, Ibrahim joins the men who live at Salah Adin Gate, a Palestinian neighborhood facing the Egyptian border, staying up all night, sitting outside and drinking coffee, waiting.
Why? We worried about our children. That's the problem. We worried about our children. We have to wake up, to be careful all the night. During the day, we're going to sleep. Have to save the children. Why? When they make entering to our area, they shot everywhere.
Ibrahim is talking about the Israeli Defense Forces, which patrol the streets of Salah Adin Gate nightly, prompting Palestinians to call the neighborhood Death's Gate. Since the beginning of the Intifada, doctors at Rafah Hospital count at least 30 children who have been shot and killed in this neighborhood, one brought to the hospital still wearing his school backpack.
Oh, it's only the beginning. They shot houses. Just houses here. Believe me, just houses here, as you see.
Ibrahim says the tanks do not come alone, but often with bulldozers. His house is among some 250 residences the Israeli military demolished under nightfall in the city of Rafah over the past 2 years. Ibrahim now lives with his family of 10 at a neighbor's house, meters from the wreckage of his former home. It is 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yes,
I come here. Why? To guard my house. Still, I want my house to be fixed again and to live again in my house. What I wait? Just to be quiet and to feel with a few peace, then to return back to normal life, which we was life before. That's all.
But not all of the men whose families have lived at Salah Adin Gate for generations can tolerate the nightly incursions by the Israeli military. After bulldozers tore down the 60 homes between the Israeli military base and Hamad Abdel Libde's house on the Egyptian border, he decided to move. He says he cannot sleep at night because of the shootings, he can't work because of his anxiety, and he's worried about his kids. The Gaza Strip is home to 1.2 million Palestinians and is the most densely populated land in the world. The nightly bulldozing of Palestinian residences all over the Gaza Strip is exacerbating an already existing housing crisis. On average, each destroyed residence housed 4 to 5 families, many having 8 to 10 members. Homeless Palestinians are forced to live with extended family or split up to live with friends. Most displaced Palestinians shun the white tents located in the center of town, donated by the United Nations. Samir Daib Zakut is the coordinator of the Al-Mazen Center for Human Rights in Rafah.
It's a way to punish Palestinians collectively. A few Palestinians take part in military resistance to the Israeli occupation. However, Israel tried to punish the whole population using similar strategies like demolishing homes and agricultural lands. It was a golden chance for Israel to go on with their frozen plans, or plans they couldn't achieve before the Intifada, to confiscate some more lands and create some pass-by roads, especially by settlements.
Over the weekend, the Israeli Defense Forces issued an order to seize an additional 15 acres of land for military needs by the settlement of Netzarim in the middle area of Gaza. For Free Speech Radio News at Salah Adin Gate, the Egyptian border with Gaza, I'm Qatar Mesta.
In a stunning decision, a Florida jury yesterday found two retired Salvadoran generals liable for the torture of three civilians by their troops during the Central American nation's civil war and ordered them to pay $54.6 million in damages. This is the first time a foreign general has been forced to personally pay damages by a U.S. court. Sally Watt has the story from Florida.
The jury said the two generals who now live in South Florida are responsible for acts of torture committed 20 years ago by troops under their command. Attorney for the victims, James Green.
Well, I mean, it sent a courageous and historic message to bad military commanders everywhere that they can't close their eyes and close their ears to torture that's occurring right under their noses. These two generals knew that there was torture, denied that there was torture, and attempted to evade responsibility for that torture.
The jurors listened to days of testimony about torture, abuse, and death. The torture victims included a doctor, a professor, and a church worker. They said they were tortured because the military believed they were cooperating with the insurgents. Neris Gonzalez was 8 months pregnant, was raped and beaten and shot. She was thrown in a truck filled with corpses from which she was able to flee. Her son was born prematurely and died of his injuries. She was awarded $21 million. Jury foreman Arnie Esben said at times it was overwhelming.
Ms. Gonzalez's testimony actually tore up the courtroom and tore up the jury. I mean, we did need a break a couple of times as far as that went. It was very, very hard to listen to those things. The photographs were bad, but nothing compared to the way things came out of her and the way that she reacted.
Carlos Mauricio, a college professor, was kidnapped and beaten for days. He suffered permanent vision damage. He was awarded $13 million. Dr. Juan Romagosa testified that he was held and beaten for 24 days. The former surgeon can no longer operate because of the damage to his hands. He was awarded $20 million. The generals did not deny that the torture took place. During the Civil War, General Vides was head of the National Guard, and General Garcia was the defense secretary. They said they didn't know about the tortures and executions and therefore could not have stopped them. Their attorney, Kurt Klaus, told jurors that El Salvador was in chaos and the generals had no knowledge of the abuses that were happening. The law that the victims sued under is the 1991 Torture Victim Protection Act that allows U.S. courts to assess damages against perpetrators of human rights abuses committed abroad. It spells out that torture and executions are personal injuries for which people can seek damages. The School of the Americas is involved in the Salvadoran general's background. The school, located in Georgia, is a combat training school for Latin American soldiers. In 1996, the Pentagon was forced to release training manuals used at the school that advocated the use of torture and execution. The school has been renamed the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. Matthew Smucker of the group School of the Americas Watch says the U.S. military had a close connection to the generals.
One of them was trained at the school. In 1962, he received training at the school. At that point, it was located in Panama. He received combat training. And the other one was, in 1985, appeared as a guest speaker at the school.
Vienna Colucci, program director at Amnesty International, says the jury decision is significant worldwide.
If we look at the big picture, for the last few years, I mean, we can look at, for example, the Pinochet case. We can look at the establishment of the International Criminal Court. We can look at some of the decisions that have been made by the two ad hoc tribunals on the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda. When you look at these developments, clearly, I think what is so welcome and important about it is that we are reinforcing each time that no one is above the law and that it is not okay to commit serious human rights violations, regardless of who you are, for no justification, and certainly not in the name of the state.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Sally Watt in St. Petersburg.
The summer heat has resulted in the death of more than 150 immigrants crossing the border from Mexico into southern Arizona. And as we wrap up our July summer special coverage of Mexico, Nick Lehman in Albuquerque reports that an Arizona faith-based organization began patrolling the desert, giving aid to illegal immigrants whose lives may be jeopardized.
The Mexican government says the numbers of people attempting to cross from Mexico into the United States is on the decline. Even so, a newly formed organization called Samaritan Patrol says 34 died in southern Arizona in June. Rick Effer Chase is the international director of Borderlinks and was involved with the formation of Samaritan Patrol.
Without worrying about where the funding was coming from, we just got together and said what needs to be done and began trying to do those things. So we've purchased a satellite phone. We have a global positioning system unit. We have signs for our vehicles. We've bought food and the water that we need. People are loaning their four-wheel drive vehicles to the project.
With Spanish-speaking volunteers, the group goes out on patrols along the Arizona and Mexican border near Ironwood National Monument and areas near Ajo, Arizona. Robbie Rodriguez is the organizing coordinator for the Southwest Organizing Project, or SWOP, that is based in New Mexico. Rodriguez says the organization deals with multicultural issues and agrees with the Samaritan Patrol's idea.
We don't feel that people are illegal, that there's no such thing as an illegal person, and that all people should be treated with dignity and respect as part of that journey towards opportunity, or at least the hope of opportunity here in this country that does not exist right now in their own, because of the economic conditions that exist, because of things like NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement.
A Mexico Foreign Department news release says 167 migrants died trying to cross the border in the past 6 months, which includes 117 Mexican citizens. For a six-month period in 2001, a total of 210 Mexican citizens died trying to cross. About 8 years ago, Congress asked the Border Patrol to enhance security along the Mexico-United States border. Rand Scudder is a public information officer for the Tucson Sector Border Patrol. He couldn't comment on the Samaritan group, but says security was installed to cut down on undocumented immigrant crossings.
At that time, Nogales was catching 1,400 people per day crossing in that area. Once resources, additional agents, air assets, everything had been stationed in that area to address the high number of illegal crossings, today those numbers, Nogales Station probably catches less than 100 people a day, from 1,400 to about 100 people a day.
Effort Chase says the enhanced security on the border is driving undocumented immigrants to remote desert areas and causing the deaths.
It's somewhat disingenuous for the Border Patrol to talk about putting 100 agents in the field and helicopters out there looking for people when, in fact, they're carrying out a policy that has forced people into the desert in the first place. It's akin to lighting a house on fire and then going in to save the occupants.
For Free Speech Radio News in Albuquerque, New Mexico, I'm Nick Lehman.
Across the country, state governments are slashing funding for social service programs in the face of declining tax revenues. Disabled rights groups are fighting back. People with disabilities were particularly concerned with cuts to the home health programs, which serve some of the most vulnerable citizens. The money pays to keep disabled people in their homes and out of institutions. Activists in Colorado took their protests over these cuts to the front door of the state human services building for a two-week round-the-clock sit-in. The state agreed late last week to restore the home health funding cuts. Daniel Costello reports from Denver.
We have our kitchen here. It's a little messy because we just finished lunch. We have our living room here. We have a TV, but in the daytime it serves as an office, so we have our computer and printer here.
Anita Cameron describes the camp that disabled rights activists occupied for 2 weeks to protest cuts in the Medicare reimbursement rate for home health care. The camp was directly outside the front door of the State Human Services Building in downtown Denver. They lived and slept outside on the sidewalk in both hail and summer heat without tents or shelter.
And the attendants come down in the evening, usually all around 9 or 10 or so, to help people, you know, get down on our beds here, our sleeping, you know, blankets and whatnot.
The activists say that attendants are essential to daily living for many disabled people, and that those people cannot live on their own without them. Rick James has lived in his own home for 15 years. He says he has a better quality of life outside of an institution. He says he would lose his house, and have to go back to a nursing home and be a nobody if he lost his home health care.
And be a nobody.
The environment of a nursing home can be very restrictive, especially for young disabled people. Most want to live independently and integrated into the rest of society. This is much more difficult when living in an institution. Dawn Russell is with the Center for People with Disabilities in Boulder.
Someone tells you when you go to bed at night. Someone tells you what you eat for dinner. You can't have sex in a nursing home. You can't have a family life. You can't do any of those things. People with disabilities need to live out in the community. There's no need for an institutional setting because people with disabilities aren't sick.
Few people with disabilities make the choice to live in a nursing home willingly, and many will do just about anything to stay out of them. Some people have moved across the country to be able to get the home health care that Colorado provides because their home state will only provide care in an institution. LaTanya Reeves fled physical and emotional abuse in a nursing home in Tennessee to come to Denver.
I'd rather die than go back into a nursing home. That's the bottom line. Or I'd rather go to jail. At least jail, there's probation. Nursing home is nothing but death.
Similar cuts have occurred or are threatened in other states, including New York and Texas. Activists in Kansas staged a one-day sit-in and were able to get some changes, but fear further cuts. Anita Cameron believes that direct action is the only way for disabled activists to have input into the budgetary process.
This was so, so important to us that we had to do it, and I assure you, had we left 2 weeks ago and just went home, no one would be speaking to us now. It was only after we sat here for 11 days that they really started to sit down and talk with us.
Karen Reinertsen, Executive Director of the Department of Healthcare Policy and Financing, says the cuts did not intentionally strike home health care.
We looked at the areas of the budget that were costing a lot of money and that kind of thing. But in general, there were a lot of across-the-board cuts, although some groups like hospitals and pharmacies took a little higher than that.
The conflict was resolved when administrators provided their budget numbers to the activists, and the activists found the $3.5 million in cuts in other programs within the same budget. The cuts came from programs including physical, occupational, and speech therapy. On the 14th day of the sit-in, the activists held a press conference and were joined by Director Karen Reinertsen. Anita Cameron announced the agreement.
We're here to announce a complete and total victory. There are no cuts in attendant services.
Yeah! Disabled activists are supporting a bill in the U.S. Congress that would allow recipients of benefits to choose how they would like to receive their care, regardless of what state they live in. The bill was first introduced over 10 years ago, but is now gaining more support and is closer to passage. The bill would not create any new entitlements, but would redirect and allow more flexibility in the spending of existing monies. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Daniel Costello in Denver.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations KPFA in Berkeley and WBAI in New York and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Aaron Glantz, headlines editor Randy Zimmerman, technical producer Jade Paget-Seekins. We have technical assistance from Kata Mester and Nell Geiser, web support from Vanessa Tate. Our interns are Rosalind Fay, Susan Chelly, Rich Kim, Fernando Romero, Christopher Martinez, and William Perdomo. I'm Deepa Fernandez.